It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is off this week. Coming up on Central Time, comedian Maz Jobrani, a frequent panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR, joins the show. First, representatives from six of the world's global powers, along with officials from Iran, are meeting in Switzerland, feverishly trying to finalize a preliminary agreement on a deal that would limit Tehran's nuclear program. Today was the self-imposed deadline to get a framework in place, though negotiations appear to be heading into an additional day, which some officials are saying signals that there's progress in the works. But what do we know about what's shaping up so far? Joining us now is Joe Greco. He's a professor of political science at Duke University. Joe, thanks for joining us today.
Rob, thank you for having me on the show.
So let's get the latest here. Negotiators breezing by the deadline, trying to wrap up with an extra day at this point, it looks like. But what do we know about progress toward a deal?
The news reporting, and that's all I'm working with, is the same news reporting that everyone else is following. I'm sure many of us are doing so quite carefully. It looks like there is a target for the production of something called a general statement basically it's going to be called a general statement. It's not going to be a framework agreement, and it's certainly not a treaty. It will be a statement. We'll have to see what the statement actually says. There's going to be some supporting documents on what needs to be done. Those supporting documents will be very, very important to read. But it looks like there will be such a general statement. The State Department spokeswoman, Marie Harf, said there was good reason to keep talking. Another important sign, the Russian foreign minister, Lavrov, who had left on Monday, returned today. That makes me think that there's some reason to believe they will come out with some sort of statement. Not sure how detailed it will be, but it may surprise us to the upside in terms of specificity.
Now, to put it at the most basic level, as I understand it, these negotiations are about loosening economic sanctions on Iran in exchange for restricting Iran's potential to produce nuclear weapons. Do I have that right in a nutshell there?
In a nutshell, that's what this is about. The United States, especially with support from its European partners, came upon, after lots of trial and error, some sanctions in 2011 and 12, which really have cut the ability of Iran to earn foreign currency and thus import goods and services. And that is what's at stake, is the relaxation of those sanctions as well as other sanctions, in exchange for which Iran would curtail its nuclear research activity and produce a window of approximately 1 year if it were to try to break out and go for an atomic weapon or nuclear weapon. The United States and its partners would have a period of time during which they could identify that and decide on what to do.
Now, one of the trickiest issues whenever we're talking about nuclear programs is how to ensure compliance, that only civilian energy-related research is being done, that things aren't bleeding over into the military side, there aren't secret facilities going on. How, in Iran or anywhere, can we be sure that a deal can be enforceable?
Yes. There would need to be, as part of this agreement, and I suspect this is part of the negotiations, an agreement by Iran to permit unannounced inspections of any site in the country. This is foreseen in nuclear diplomacy, and under the terms of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, the technical term for it is an agreement under an additional protocol to the NPT treaty, whereby the International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors could show up. Basically, they would be given several entry visas, and they could basically arrive unannounced in the country and go to any site in the country. This, I think, is going to be an important part of any agreement. There will need to be other elements, but in terms of electronic monitoring, video monitoring, it's never possible to be 100% sure, but there are things that can be done to enhance confidence and ability to verify compliance. And if you see the term additional protocol 2, that's a positive sign.
Talking to political scientist Joe Greco about ongoing negotiations. Deadline was today. Looks like they're going to tomorrow over Iran's nuclear program. Now, this is complicated enough with the nuclear issue, the sanction issue, and it's all going on while the U.S. is, in effect, cooperating with Iran to combat ISIS in Iraq and working against Iran's efforts in places like Yemen, Lebanon, West Bank, Gaza, Syria. Do these other issues, these outside issues, affect the negotiations in any way?
My guess, oddly enough, is that the answer is no. These individuals, this is such a big standalone project. It reminds me of the strategic nuclear weapons talks between the United States and the Soviet Union, wherein even while the United States was involved in a war with one of Soviet Union's allies, namely North Vietnam, the two were making big efforts to try to control nuclear weapons. So I don't think those issues, which you correctly noted, are out there and are part of the very strange politics, regional politics of the Middle East. In terms of actually impinging on these talks, my guess is that it's pretty limited. Of course, the United States, I suspect, is hoping that if an agreement is reached, that this will lead to further a reduction in tension between the United States and Iran, and possibly between Iran and some of its neighbors. But I personally think this is a pretty self-encapsulated set of negotiations.
Well, let's look at another potentially complicating political factor closer to home.
Yes.
The U.S. Congress invited Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu over to talk about this. He's not wild about this deal. Does congressional opposition jeopardize these negotiations in any way?
I think congressional oversight and the possibility that Congress will pass legislation that the president would veto, but perhaps there are veto-proof formulations of the legislation, bringing Congress in, are a part of the negotiations. I don't think the Secretary Kerry has to tell his counterpart, the Foreign Minister, Mr. Zarif, that if he doesn't make a deal at present, he might face harder sanctions 6 months from now when the current sort of a standstill agreement runs out at the end of June. So, yes, I think there are two factors in the United States that must influence the Iranian counterparts. One, this congressional action. Number two, the presidential campaign. They must be wondering, gee whiz, would they like to make a deal now, or do they want to wait until January 2017? And they must ask themselves, do they think any of the likely successors to President Obama would give them a better deal? And it's not clear that they would get that.
Now, a lot of times a president's second term or maybe even later in a first term is one where presidents are thinking about their legacy and a foreign policy legacy. Some try to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian crisis. That doesn't look like it's in reach for President Obama. If the president succeeds, if these negotiations succeed, is this a big win for President Obama's legacy on foreign policy?
It could be a big win. It certainly is the hope of the Obama administration, that this agreement would not just put a cap on the nuclear weapons program that might be taking place in Iran, but lead to a more general improvement in relations between the two countries and perhaps a mellowing of the regime in terms of its treatment of its own population and its foreign policy. But I think the proof would be, and I think President Obama knows this, the proof would, in terms of his legacy, would be not this year, not next year, but in 7 years, 10 years, 15 years. In other words, people would look back and say, yes, the agreement did mark a moment of positive improvement. But if it does fail, if it does actually create a smokescreen behind which Iran can develop nuclear weapons, that would be the end of Obama's reputation. So I think he knows it is a legacy event, and it's a double-edged sword.
Joe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. It was a great pleasure.
That was Joe Greco, professor of political science at Duke University, talking about the ongoing nuclear negotiations with Iran. If you're a fan of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, you are familiar with our next guest. Comedian and actor Maz Jobrani is a panelist on the show. He was last with us on Central Time when Wait, Wait did a show in Wisconsin last summer. Since then, he's released a new book, I'm Not a Terrorist, But I've Played One on TV, Memoirs of a Middle Eastern Funny Man. In the book, he talks about his comedy, his Persian-American identity, and being shot by Chuck Norris. Maz, welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks for having me back.
Well, let's start with that part of your origin story as a performer. How did you find yourself in a turban being shot on screen by Chuck Norris?
You know, not all of us are that lucky. You know, some of us are privileged. It was early in my career, and I still had a day job working as an assistant in an advertising agency. So I got this part as an Afghan terrorist who was going to Chicago to blow up a building. This was before September 11th. And being of Middle Eastern descent, I struggled with taking the part at first. I said, you know, should I do this? Should I not do this? And then I thought, you know, maybe I can do the part and show through my acting ability why this guy is doing what he's doing. I thought I could be a great thespian and prove that there's a reason why this guy's doing what he's doing. And so I went down to film, and when I went to the wardrobe fitting, they said, here's your shirt, here's your pants, here's your turban. Hmm. And I said, oh, guys, actually Afghans in America don't wear turbans. Indian Sikhs wear turbans. Let's get this right. And they basically said, dude, this is a Chuck Norris movie. We don't know what you're talking about. And I said, no, let's just get this right. I told the wardrobe girl, I said, please tell the producers I'm not going to wear the turban. So she went and spoke with them. And the next day I went to my wardrobe, to my dressing room, and there was my shirt and my pants and what looked like a scarf. And I said, okay. I go, see, I told you if you talk to them, they'll see it my way. I will gladly be the scarf-wearing terrorist. And she said, no, that's not the scarf. That's the turban. You just got to wrap it back up. So I felt like an idiot wearing a turban in a Chuck Norris movie and getting killed by him.
And he didn't even beat you up. He just shot you in the movie. That's the
he
big bummer.
He shot me. Yeah, it was a bummer. I honestly thought we'd have a fight scene. I think one of the earlier drafts had us maybe doing some fighting. And I was really bummed out that when the day came to do it, he told his son, who was the director, he said, you know, I think maybe I should just shoot the guy. And I thought, oh, come on. And basically, I come running into this room that he's in, and I have to scream the obligatory Allahu Akbar or something like that, and then he just shoots me, and I'm gone.
So on screen, you often, get maybe these roles as terrorists. Do you see typecasting in your daily life over the years?
You know, I in all honesty, what happened was early on, that those were the parts that were out there, and I did a couple of them. I did the Chuck Norris movie, I did the TV show 24, and then after that I said no more terrorist parts. So I was able to stop doing those. And I say this a lot, I don't mind playing a taxi, you know, a cab driver, I don't mind playing a falafel store owner. Some of these other parts I don't mind. It's the terrorist thing that really bothers me. And so I have said no to those. And in my day-to-day, I don't really encounter that much racism myself, because I think that not having an accent and people look at me, I think sometimes they think he could be Latino, he could be, we don't know, something. He could be Middle Eastern. So I don't get it as much myself. But I've had friends and relatives get stuff. For example, after September 11th, my mother, who does have a thick Persian accent, she was at a Costco in Los Angeles, and she was shopping, and there was a cart in her way that nobody was claiming, so my mother moved the cart to get to the product she was trying to get, and then this lady came back and said, who moved my cart? And my mother, with her thick Persian accent, said, you know, I had to move it to get to my product. And the lady turned to my mom and said, why don't you just go back to your country? And this was right after 9/11. And so my mom was faced with this racism right there, where, and then she told the lady, she said, this is my country. And then as the lady was leaving, the lady turned to my mom and called her the B word. And my mother came back with the best 5-year-old comeback. She said, she who says it is it. And I thought that was a good comeback for my mom.
Now, you tackle these issues in your comedy. Is it ever a tough balancing act? So, you know, you want to be funny, you're a comedian, and you want to solve all the world's problems too. Does one step on the other sometimes?
I try to make sure that whatever I talk about, if it's a serious topic, I try to make sure that there's jokes at the end, so that people leave laughing, as opposed to just preaching. For example, there's a joke I've been doing about the Boston bombings. And I never make fun of the victims. I always make sure to make fun of either the perpetrators of the crime or those in power. For example, in the Boston bombing situation, I make fun of the media coverage and how immediately everybody pointed at possible Middle Easterners or Arabs being behind it. And I don't know if you remember, but the New York Post took a picture of two Moroccans who happened to be at the finish line wearing backpacks, and they put it on the cover, and they said, basically, these are the guys. The headline read, Bag Men, and it turned out those poor guys weren't the guys. And so I make fun of the New York Post in that situation, but I make sure to have the joke in there when I'm talking about a serious issue. And I also open that issue by saying the Boston bombings were a tragic event, and my first thought was that my heart went out to the victims, but then my second thought as a Middle Easterner was just, please don't be Middle Eastern, please don't be Middle Eastern. And of course the news came out, they said they're Chechenian, and I was like, yes, and then they go, but they're Muslim. I was like, oh, come on. So, it's just a way of handling a serious topic and making sure that you have a joke at the end.
Talking to Maz Jobrani, comedian, actor, wait, don't tell me, panelist. His new book is I'm Not a Terrorist, But I've Played One on TV. Now, Maz, how did your family react to your decision to be a comedian and an actor?
I think that they were not too into it. When you have immigrant parents, a lot of these parents, whatever country you're from, a lot of parents come from a struggle, whether it's a civil war or a revolution or what have you, and they come to America and they set up shop, and their whole hope is that their kids become lawyers or doctors or engineers, something that's reputable. So when I first told my parents I wanted to be an actor or a comedian, my mother didn't even know what I was talking about. I remember she was trying to convince me to just be a lawyer. She would say, listen, just be a lawyer and maybe you can just tell some jokes in court. And I was like, I don't know about that, Mom. And she said, no, just you'll be funny on the weekends. And it was this constant battle. And it was interesting because I went from trying to be a lawyer. I did undergrad at UC Berkeley in political science. And then I decided, you know, I don't want to be a lawyer. Maybe I'll be a professor. Maybe that's a good compromise. That'll be reputable, but it'll also be me in front of people talking, and it'll be a little more dynamic. And when I told my mom that I wanted to be a professor, she thought I was losing my mind. But then when I actually got into a PhD program at UCLA and ended up dropping out of that. And when I told her I wanted to drop out of that, she said, listen, you don't want to be a lawyer. You're not going to be a professor. At least be a mechanic. And I go, how'd you go from lawyer to mechanic? She goes, listen to me. She goes, people need mechanics. Nobody needs an actor. And those were very wise words, actually.
Well, but you've been somewhat successful. Your mom impressed, or is it still some reservation here?
No, I think she's come around. It's always funny to me with my mom because you have certain levels of success and she's with you, but then and I talk about it in the book that I portray her in a certain way, but she doesn't always say the things that I've written in the book. I think I write that in the book it was more what I hear when she says things. So, for example, growing up, she would say, I was at my friend's house, and her son, his room was so clean, and he gets really good grades. Why can't you be more like Michael or whoever? I would hear, in my mind, I would hear her saying, I wish I never would have had you. I would have just left you back in Iran. Like, that's how I would interpret it. So to this day, even though my mother supports my success, there's times when she'll come over to my house. And years ago, I was on a TV show that Sofia Vergara was on as well, and now Sofia Vergara's career is taken off to, you know, from Modern Family and all other stuff. So she'll come over, and even though she's supportive, she'll say things like, you know, maybe you should think about changing your agents. And I go, what are you talking about? She goes, Sofia is doing very well. And I go, well, I'm doing pretty well. She goes, yeah, but you're not doing as well as Sofia. So the way I hear her is she's saying, you're still not quite where I need you to be. You know, and the other one she always tells me, she'll say things like, her and my aunts, they say, you know, the day you win the Oscar, we will be very happy. Like, they want me to win an Oscar. Like, if I don't get an Oscar, they're not happy.
Now, you've done stand-up in the U.S. and around the world, and I wanted to briefly, as we wrap up here, what's the difference between doing, you know, a dive comedy club in the U.S. and, say, performing in front of the King of Jordan?
Well, I would say that the pressure is a little higher. When we did the shows in front of the King of Jordan in Jordan, it was an interesting situation because he was in the audience, and this was during the war with Iraq and the Bush administration, and there were some jokes I would do about Bush and Ahmadinejad at the time. And when I would get to those jokes, I would look at him to kind of say, listen, dude, you can do something about this. And so that was a very interesting dynamic, to have a king in the audience that could possibly take some of your jokes as suggestions and implement them. Whereas if you're doing a show at a dive bar in America, you're just hoping they understand what you're saying and they're not too drunk to heckle you.
Maz, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's comedian Maz Jobrani. His new book is called I'm Not a Terrorist, But I've Played One on TV. Here in the Midwest, we're all familiar with the costs of rust and corrosion. Just look at your car, for example. If you live in the South, you might be able to keep the family car looking nice maybe for decades, but here, the road salt and the elements take their toll, eating away at the paint and the body of our cars. And that's just a little piece of the puzzle when it comes to the price of rust. Looked at broadly, rust costs the United States nearly $500 billion every year, more than all natural disasters combined. Rust is said to pose the number one threat to the U.S. Navy, and the Department of Defense even has an Office of Corrosion Policy and Oversight. Corrosion is also part of the reason the American Society of Civil Engineers gave the U.S. a D+ in their most recent report card on American infrastructure. So as winter goes away, we all get to take a firsthand look at the damage the elements can do. Writer Jonathan Waldman joins us to talk about the challenges we face when we're dealing with rust. His new book is called Rust, The Longest War. Jonathan, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So how does rust cost the U.S. that much money, $500 billion a year? How does it all add up to that?
How does it add up? It couldn't possibly be that much, right? I mean, it's cars, it's planes, it's ships, it's guardrails on the sides of roads, it's rebar that rusts, it's bridges that fall down, it's concrete that ends up splitting apart because rebar is rusting away inside the concrete. It's kind of everywhere. I mean, we use more metal per capita than we've ever used before in history, so it's kind of no surprise that the cost is so high, and you know, that's kind of another way of looking at it.
Well, one thing that amazed me in your book is we've known about rust for a long time. You quote, I think, a Roman general talking about how their catapults were more of a danger to their own troops because of rust. We've only really started to understand why it happens and what it is in the last 100 years.
Yeah, it's really neat. Electrochemistry is not that old a field. I like what Robert Boyle described, I think, around the year 1600. He thought that rust was due to little holes in metal, and he thought that certain liquids could get in there and sort of interfere with the metal, but that's not what it is. It has to do with all but four metals in the universe give up their electrons pretty readily to oxygen or chlorine or I guess those are the big two, and, you know, it's called oxidation. Oxygen just happens to be the most abundant element on Earth. Chlorine happens to be in all of our oceans, so it's almost like cosmically we were not really meant to sail metal ships across the oceans.
So what are some of the structures that are most affected by rust that add up to that $500 billion price tag?
Well, if you look at the Department of Defense, they have a pretty good breakdown. And the DOD is sort of a subset or a microcosm of what the country as a whole sort of has. So about a quarter of their costs are facilities and infrastructure. You know, they've got bases, they've got wharves, they've got marinas, they've got, hangars where they keep planes and helicopters. Then they've also got a few hundred odd ships, and they've got tens of thousands of vehicles, and those are all rusting away. And then they've got weapons, and you and I don't have weapons, but we have metal things. You know, we have bikes, and we have barbecue grills, and we have tools that are rusting away, probably in the garage. In fact, that's you there?
Oop, yeah, I think we're losing you a little, Jonathan. So you were talking about the various things that rust affects in our lives.
Yeah, so I don't know. My phone made a weird noise. I don't know what what the last thing you heard was.
Well, let's dig deeper into the military side of this. We mentioned the Pentagon's Corrosion Policy and Oversight Office. Now, one practical application for people is this costs a lot of money, rust and corrosion. The idea here, I guess, is if the Pentagon can save money on all those marinas and ships and other facilities and weapons you're talking about, we're saving a lot of taxpayer money. So how much progress are they making there?
Oh, they're making a ton of progress. They've only been doing this for about a dozen years. And at first, there was a lot of resistance. A lot of guys working on $100 million weapon systems, they were like, Rust, that's not an interesting problem. You know, I'm building weapons that are going to blow up and kill the enemy. You're talking to me about rust? I don't even want to hear it. But there's a very determined and quirky and personable guy who is not an engineer, who sees rust as a cultural problem, who said, look, we're going to have to spend millions, but we're going to save billions. And if we keep doing things the way we are, we can't afford to, you know, defend our country the way we want if we let rust interfere the way it is. So he's this guy, I don't want to say single-handedly, but with the help of a very small office and some bright people, his little office has saved billions of dollars for the U.S. Department of Defense.
Now, we also mentioned infrastructure in the country. We hear annual reports talking about the woeful state of things like bridges in the United States, roadways, things like that. How big a part of our problem with our infrastructure is rust and corrosion?
Probably the big problem. I mean, you notice, after, a lot of people have told me after they read the book, they look around and they see the world differently. And all of a sudden, you're driving down the road and you realize how much stuff is made of metal. It's tempting to think, well, it's all asphalt, but it's not all asphalt. You can't just build a bridge out of asphalt, and you can't the Romans built stuff just out of rock, so they didn't have the rust problems we have. Bridges, tunnels, everything you see in the modern world has metal underlying it or holding it up or there somehow. So I don't know. That doesn't sound too detailed, but that's how it is.
We're talking about the impact of rust and corrosion with Jonathan Waldman. His new book is called Rust, The Longest War. We'll talk about looking at the world in a different way, Jonathan. You delved deeply into the making of cans, like as in a can of soda or a can of green beans. We think of this as a simple. This is one of the basics in our lives that are all over the place. Yet, when we think about it, look closely, this is one of the most amazing feats of engineering we're going to encounter.
It's true. I discovered when looking at cans something I found also when looking at rust in general, which is familiarity. It creates a sort of complacency. We see rust so much, we think we get it, but it turns out we don't get it at all, and most of us are very unfamiliar with the relatively few corrosion engineers out there protecting metal objects from sort of a natural death. And with cans, we buy six packs and drink beer and soda all the time, but we never stop and think, oh, my God, putting corrosive stuff in a can is somehow marvelous. And our grandparents or great-grandparents kind of would have been amazed that this was even possible. It turns out Mountain Dew is about as corrosive as battery acid, yet we insist on calling it an aluminum can. Really, it's a plastic can. And I say that because in the manufacturing process, they squirt an epoxy into every aluminum can, and that epoxy is tailored to every individual food and beverage, and it has to do, the amount that they use has to do with how corrosive the foods and beverages are that need to be guarded against with the can.
And you actually went to something called Can School to learn how this is done. What happens at Can School?
Can School is an industry-only event. I happen to live just up the road from the world's largest can maker. And when I heard about Can School, I couldn't resist. No journalist had been before, and when they realized I was there and asking some sensitive questions, I nearly got kicked out. And actually, this was years ago, and actually only last week did I get my Can School diploma. But I was there, it was there at Can School where I heard can-making people talk about cans as time bombs. And they call them time bombs because you're putting this extra corrosive stuff inside a sliver of aluminum about as thick as a piece of paper. And that plastic that we use to protect the aluminum, it's the controversial stuff that we got rid of in baby bottles. It's bisphenol A, better known as BPA. And I found out that Well, the whole industry doesn't really want to talk about it. Most people think we solved the problem because, you know, we got rid of it in baby bottles and sippy cups. But it's in all of our foods and beverages that are stored in cans. And I talked to a guy who has some patents on some of these coatings, and he said, I know what goes into them. I know how they can go wrong, and I won't drink from a can. And this wasn't at Can School per se, but this was sparked by Can School. And he told me that he thinks the Surgeon General should change the warning on cans. So instead of saying that women who are pregnant shouldn't drink alcoholic beverages, he thinks it should say women shouldn't drink canned beverages.
Is there, maybe you encountered this at Can School, are there efforts to change the coatings that keep these cans from rusting to use different materials?
Yeah,
or is this a bigger challenge than that?
Oh, it's a huge challenge, and it gets to the nature of engineering, which is always a compromise. And so BPA was phased out in a lot of plastics. Unfortunately, the alternative, which is usually BPS, which is sort of an analog to BPA, it has the same estrogenic effects. It causes cancer in mice, and it turns out the threshold that it might not be so good for us is much lower than the FDA allows, you know, like 1,000 to 1,000,000 to maybe even 10 million times lower. And there's 400 other plastics that all produce some sort of estrogenic activity. But in a way, this shouldn't be a great surprise. The perfect materials were discovered long ago. They're rock. They're iron, and iron has a life expectancy. So when you try to synthesize some modern chemical that can do way more than is perhaps naturally allowable, it's not surprising that there's some other consequence that we're just discovering.
We're talking to Jonathan Waldman about his new book, Rust, The Longest War, and we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Rust costs the U.S. nearly $500 billion a year, said to be the number one threat to the U.S. Navy. I want to know, are you in the middle of this war with rust, maybe at your workplace, at home, on your car? Do you have questions about corrosion, how it works, what it is, what it does? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation now about the cost of rust and corrosion with Jonathan Waldman. His new book is called Rust, The Longest War, and you can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have questions about the engineering problem that is rust, and if you are fighting a war with rust, maybe where you work, maybe at home. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to a caller. We've got Daryl on the line in Beaver Dam. Daryl, hi.
Hi, how are you doing there? Thanks for having me. I wanted to ask if your man there was aware of the beams, the cast iron beams, and some of the old Roman buildings, the antique buildings, and how they protected them from corrosion by coating them with lead.
I was just going to say, I hope you're about to talk to me about white lead. I am familiar with that stuff.
So what's the deal with lead-covered iron beams among the Romans, Jonathan?
So I suspect, I'm not sure of this, but my suspicion is it's kind of an early version of galvanizing. And galvanizing works because you're sort of giving, I hate to say it like this, but you're sort of giving nature something to chew on. Zinc is very willing to corrode, and so when you coat something in zinc, the zinc sort of corrodes instead of the thing you're trying to protect. And my suspicion is that when you coat iron and lead, the lead is the thing that goes instead of the iron. But it also could just make a pretty darn good paint, and the Romans didn't exactly have modern paints that we have today.
Daryl, thanks a lot for that call. And that's a key often in efforts to prevent rust, some kind of alloy, mixing metals, protecting one metal with another. Is that right?
Yeah, so electroplating is kind of a fancy version of galvanizing. There's a number of corrosion-resistant metals you can cover other metals with, but it doesn't necessarily work in every application. It's a real expensive way to go. Galvanizing is what we do on bridges, say in Ohio or even Florida. There actually aren't that many ways to. There's only a handful of ways to fight rust, so it's kind of a. It's a funny story, what I wrote. It's kind of, well, do we have it in us to handle maintenance? Because there is no magical technical solution that will sort of wipe it all out forever. It's, It's a matter of attending to stuff and looking at it and being sure it's in good shape.
We'll go back to our calls now. Richard is with us in La Crosse. Richard, hi. Richard, are you there?
Yes.
Oh, what did you want to bring up, Richard?
My question is, do you know anything about the new stuff they're putting on the highways this day and age? It's a liquid that they pre-treat the roads before, like a snowstorm in the northern snow belt. And I've talked to body men, and they said this stuff is like 10 times more corrosive than road salt. And from personal experience, I have a pretty new truck pickup, and in like 2 years, my truck was like covered with rust underneath. I'm like, can I keep it clean, you know? I'm like, I took it to the dealer.
Yeah, so
thanks, Richard. Jonathan, go ahead.
Yeah, so the National Association of Corrosion Engineers, I think, wrote a story. I'm going to forget where it was, but their annual convention was a couple of weeks ago, and there was a story about this type of salt. And I'm going to get it wrong because I've had a lot of chemical names in my head lately, but it's either magnesium chloride or some other kind of chloride. And they said, oh, driving behind the trucks that apply that stuff to the road is like absolutely the worst thing you can do. Like, don't drive behind those trucks and try not to be on the road that day.
Wow.
But that's, again, that's the trade-off, right? Is if you want to drive in the winter and you want to live in Wisconsin, that's what it might take. Otherwise, you're going to have to drive a lot slower or get studded snow tires or just not leave your house.
All right, Richard, thanks for the call. Talking to Jonathan Waldman, his new book is about rust and the huge expense it causes us here in the United States every year. Corey is with us next in Green Bay. Corey, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to bring up, Corey?
I'm a mechanic here in Green Bay, and rust is just a constant issue that is falling off cars. Cars are actually in disrepair because the rust eats suspension so badly and the body. It's a never-ending battle.
Yeah,
you could wash your car every day, and it wouldn't make a difference.
Well, I do mine something like twice a year, so I'm probably in trouble. So, yeah, it's not just cosmetic, Jonathan. This is doing serious damage to the important bits of the car that make the car go.
Oh, yeah, one of my favorite anecdotes. I do this when I do book talks at bookstores. I ask people to raise their hands about car damage because the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration has recalled cars on account of corrosion, because corrosion has caused everything from wiper failure to airbag failure to steering failure to axle failure and engine failure. But the grand prize, in my estimation, goes to Ford, because corrosion could cause parked vehicles to catch fire. And I used to ask people, I'd say, well, raise your hand if rust ever made your car go boom. And I have heard from two people who had that happen to them.
No kidding. Thanks a lot for the call, Corey. I wanted to bring up another stop that your research took you to, about 20 minutes drive from where I'm sitting right now. You checked out the Rust Store based in Middleton, Wisconsin.
That's right. I was sort of hoping that John Carmona, the owner of the Rust Store, would call up, but he's probably busy solving rust problems over there. And actually, I'm sad to admit I never made it to the store, but we talked on the phone a number of times and exchanged a lot of emails. And believe it or not, in a country of 300 million people, there's only one, you know, if you don't count Home Depot, which only has a few dozen rust products, the Rust Store is the only store dedicated to selling products to combat rust in kind of a non-commercial application, although they do also sell things to pretty big companies in faraway places.
But this is for people who want to keep, say, their car or other metal things in good repair. And it's kind of a bold stance in a disposable throwaway culture. This is an effort to keep using the same stuff instead of replacing it.
Yeah, and John Carmona fields a lot of interesting calls. He gets a surprise every day. Sometimes people want to know how to keep their weapons or their guns from rusting. Some guys want to know how to keep the power tools they have, their woodworking tools, around. Some guys want to work on their boats. Some people want to remove rust stains from their driveways or from their golf clubs. I mean, you name it, he's dealt with it before.
All right, we'll take one more caller. I think we've got Dan on the line in Marathon. Dan, hi.
Hi. Yeah, going back to your comment or your guest comment about magnesium chloride, the bulk of the counties in the state of Wisconsin are using a salt brine solution. They're spraying bridges and roads for what's called anti-icing. It's a 23% solution of salt dissolved in water. Very few are using magnesium chloride. So realistically, what gets sprayed on the roads during the winter for for frost and that is minor compared to the amount of salt that's used for de-icing, which is actually when it's actually snowing out.
Dan, thanks a lot for the call and clarifying that. But however we put the salt on the road, we put a lot of it on the road, and it affects the cars and the bridges, right, Jonathan?
Yeah, and I'm sad to admit I'm not familiar with the county by county salt procedures up in Wisconsin, but I guess the bigger point is that we always talk about the Rust Belt, but some of the corrosion consultants I talked to, they said forget the Rust Belt, it's all about the Salt Belt states, and the Salt Belt is everywhere north and east of Kansas City, Missouri, and it's there that salt is applied to the roads either before it snows or while it's snowing. And that's what ends up eating away at a lot of our infrastructure.
Jonathan, thanks a lot for taking the time and giving us new insight into the world of rust.
Yeah, I hope I didn't make it too boring. You know, the book's a lot funner than just, it gets this and it gets that.
That's Jonathan Waldman. He's a journalist and author. We've been talking about his new book. It's called Rust, The Longest War. You can continue the conversation on the Central Time Facebook page, and maybe if you have a good rust picture, that's one thing we didn't get into, the aesthetics of rust, you can share that as well on the Central Time Facebook page. Some news from the world of fast food. Don't think this is an April Fool's joke either. McDonald's, they're big. A lot of McDonald's out there. They're doing a test run in California, I think, having some of their breakfast items available all day. We're going to bring in Central Time producer and for today breakfast correspondent Chris Molina on this. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Rob. This is the dream, isn't it? I mean, to be able to walk into a McDonald's and get an Egg McMuffin at like 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Now, they're just giving it a trial run, so nothing is set in stone, but McDonald's is a company that's sort of struggling right now. But, you know, a lot of times for me, you know, McDonald's is a place that you go on a road trip because it happens to be there. But the one time that I seek it out on purpose is in the morning to get that sausage Egg McMuffin.
Right, and usually in my life when I've wanted those things, I'm there too late. I'm a big all-day breakfast day guy. Mm-hmm. Diners that serve breakfast all day, it's great. Used to love the McDonald's hash browns. I don't know, is there a potato in there? I'm not sure. I don't know if I'd still go for that. 20 years ago, I would have been really excited about this.
You know, and I'm still really excited about it. I hope it's not the kind of thing where, you know, like they dangle it in front of you like the McRib or the Shamrock Shake where it's there for a month and then it's gone. Let's hope this is something that's here to stay.
That's a logistical problem, too, like having a grill big enough to do the burgers and this and that and still room for the, you know, Egg McMuffins.
That's what they always say. So maybe they'll trim it down. Maybe it's going to be some limited items. We'll see.
All right. Chris, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Rob.